Good afternoon. This is the Heritage Radio Network, Aaron Fitzpatrick at the root of it. Quick thank you to our sponsor, VS Imports, today. A fine selection of Italian wines in their portfolio. Thank you to Donato. It's Tuesday, June 16th, and we're going to start this show's segment with the Weekend Wine Recap. With sad news that Paul Avril, who ran his family's famed Clos de Pape estate in the southern Rhone, Chateauneuf du Pape appellation, has died at the age of 72, causes due to cancer. And the renowned Piedmontese wine producer Bruno Giacosa has announced that he will not be bottling his 2006 Barolos and Barbarescos, as he's not satisfied with the standards of this particular vintage. He has suffered a stroke in 2006, which left him unable to work at the winery, and these particular wines from this vintage were not good enough to bottle, according to him. So quite of a loss of financial sacrifice coming from that winery. And in other news, new organic labeling policies have been introduced between the Agriculture Marketing Service and the Alcohol and Tobacco Trade Bureau. Wine labeled with made with organic ingredients statements must indicate the presence of non-organic grapes in the made with organic statement on the label. Organic ingredient statement must indicate the presence of any non-organic grapes such as Merlot, Cabernet, tartric acid, and also indicate a percentage statement on the label. However, when 100% of the ingredients are organic on a wine restricted to an organic ingredient statement, a percentage statement is prohibited in order to avoid customer confusion with products meeting 100% organic wine standard. In tastings this week, Tuesday, June 16th, the Rudy Palooza with Rudy Weist is trade-only tasting at Tribeca Grill. We also have American Sommelier Association with Grant Phelps, who's my guest today, enologist and chief winemaker for Viuminette. This is a tasting that's open to the American Sommelier Association, sommeliers, and wine buyers to taste through the Viuminette portfolio at Sojourn Restaurant from 12 to 2. Also, a slow food event celebrating Beirut will be held at Ilili Restaurant at 236 Fifth Avenue from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. Slow food members, it's $90, non-members, $100. Philippe Massoud, who is the New York-based Lebanese chef and owner of Ilili, will be welcoming Rami Zarak, co-founder of Slow Food Beirut, to talk about traditional Lebanese food and culture. And as I mentioned, my guest today is Grant Phelps, who's in town from Chile. And we're going to be doing a two-part segment, running this week's segment and next week's show with Conversations with Grant. We're going to take a quick music interlude and be right back with our guest. Can't make it split. Jim, can you record the talk back? Record that, Jim. Bet. Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. That was a little number from Spoon, Don't You Ever. We're at Roberta's today, and my guest today is Grant Phelps, who's in town all the way from Colchagua Valley in Chile. Hi, Grant.
Hey, Aaron.
Thrilled to have you here. He just landed at JFK and is in Bushwick 2 hours later, so we're thrilled to have you here on the network.
Well, here I am, fresh off the boat. Good to see you again, though, Aaron.
Nice to see you. I participated in the vintage, was it last year?
At Viuminette.
Yep. So I worked in the cellar with Grant, and we're still friends, so it's nice to...
It's amazing, and you know, if anyone out there has any problems with the 2008 wines, that was Aaron's fault.
That is my fault.
Everything that went wrong in the cellar was basically Aaron, but It was a bit of an issue actually for us, because having a hot New Yorker cruising around the winery, even with her rubber boots, she distracted the little Chilean workers. There were a lot of accidents.
Well, how was that vintage? How was it speaking in terms of Chilean terms?
2008? Good year.
Good year.
For me, it was an above average Cabernet year, an exceptional Syrah and Malbec year. The only thing that was a little bit, for me, not that impressive was maybe the Carmenere last year. But we just wrapped up the 09 vintage. We finished picking our last grapes on Thursday, actually.
Wow. So, under the gun.
Yeah. That was the late harvest or the Botrytis Semillon. But this year was excellent. Very, very dry year. And for me, an exceptional Cabernet Sauvignon year. Of the 9 vintages I've done in Chile, it was the best cab year I've ever seen. So
nice.
Very good.
Yeah. Good. I mean, the great thing. 9 years you've been in Chile.
Nine long years. It feels like about 50, but it's only been 9 years.
But you still sound like a Kiwi, so...
There you go.
It is now home, but you still have those New Zealand roots, yeah?
You can take the boy out of the islands, but you can't take the islands out of the boy.
How did you end up there?
In Chile? Yeah. Well, basically, I got into wine when I was a bartender, actually. I was studying zoology and started just getting interested in wine because I was pouring wines in the bar where I was working. Mm-hmm. And literally a patron came in one night and asked me about some wine that I was pouring. And because I am a compulsive know-it-all, I had to start learning about wine when I started pouring them.
Right.
And he asked me some question about this Pinot that I was pouring. And so I told him a little bit about the winery, what I'd read somewhere. And he said, well, you know all about wine. You should study to be a winemaker. And I said to him, don't be silly. That's not a real job. And he said, yeah, no, it is. There's one university that has a wine program. This was back in the early 90s, and indeed there was. Mm-hmm. And I went to the university the next day. I was about to start my master's degree in zoology, and it was the last day of enrollment for the wine program. So on an absolute whim, I enrolled in the wine program to do a master's.
Wow. That is compulsive.
It was a little bit out of the blue, but no, it turned out to be a good decision. I mean, wine
clearly,
wine's turned out to be something that I love working with or doing, and I mean, basically after that, I did my master's thesis in Pinot Noir, so I started off as a Pinot expert, if you like, and started working the vintages between New Zealand and Oregon for the first few years. After that, I started working for three different English companies, working as what's called a flying winemaker. So basically, they'd send me off to just go into a winery and make the wine for them for the harvest, so contracts of 3 or 4 months. Doing that, I worked in Australia, in California, in Hungary, France.
Wow.
And I wound up in Chile. And
was that on a flying winemaker gig, or was that more permanent?
Well, to be honest, the first time I went to Chile was just out of curiosity. When I was working as a flying winemaker in Europe in the mid-90s, I think it was 1996, I was in London meeting with my boss there, and it was the day of the annual Wines of Chile tasting in London, which we just had our annual Wines of Chile tasting in New York last week.
Sure.
But this was the one in London, and I basically met with my boss. We went over what was going to happen for the vintage in France. Mm-hmm. And afterwards he said, hey, there's a tasting downstairs, Wines of Chile, if you want to go and have a look. I'd literally never tasted Chilean wine. I mean, the only Chilean wines being imported to New Zealand back in the mid-90s were Gato Negro and Casillero del Diablo, which were cheap and nasty. And so I literally went downstairs and tasted 350 wines in one day. And it was literally everything that Chile was exporting to the UK at that time. And it blew me away, to be honest.
Really?
It showed me just the potential that Chile had. And I think as a winemaker tasting all of these wines, I could see that the raw material was amazing, but that there were certain sort of stylistic problems, maybe a little bit of funky wine making going on. You could see the wine industry was still had a wee way to go in terms of perfecting its craft.
Right.
But you could see that the raw material was extraordinary. So I guess that sowed the seeds for me of curiosity.
Sure.
I went back to New Zealand and worked for a few years there for Villa Maria, which is a pretty well-known company, and basically got bored with living in New Zealand, which it's a lovely country, but...
Small.
It's small, and after 25 or 26 years living there, I was a bit over it, to be honest.
Right.
So New Zealanders, we're pretty famous for our wanderlust. We have to get out eventually. And so that happened to me, basically. The travel bug hit, and I decided it was time to leave again. And I thought, where would I most like to go and make wine where I haven't been? And so Chile was the first thing that popped to mind.
Excellent. That's a very cool story.
Well, yeah, I'm going to send off my CV to a Kiwi guy I knew who was consulting to a Chilean winery, and the next day they rang me and offered me a job. So that was it.
What are the differences or the challenges for being a flying winemaker and being a winemaker at a particular vineyard or winery?
Well, it's very different. I mean, as a flying winemaker, you're typically making cheap wine. The flying winemaking phenomenon started off, it was started off by the English supermarkets, essentially. In the early 90s or the very late 80s, the English supermarkets, basically the English, started getting into wine at sort of the every man kind of English wine drinker started that concept. So people just started drinking wine with food, which before that in England, it was very much sort of an elitist thing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the 80s, everyone started drinking wine and people wanted cheap wine. And that was something that hadn't really existed in England before. Wine was very much for people who knew a lot about wine already. So the
sellers of a distinguished gentleman.
Exactly. And so the supermarkets started getting into selling cheaper wine.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they had to start sourcing wine from places other than Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Right.
Because you couldn't get £5 a bottle wines from those regions. They're too famous and the costs of production were too high. So that's when these supermarkets started buying wine from the south of France, from lesser known regions of Italy, from Eastern Europe. And the only problem was that you'd buy 1 year from a producer and the wines would be great, and the next year the wines would be awful. There was no consistency, and the supermarkets really had no way to control that. So the concept of flying winemaking came about because these guys decided to send in their own winemakers. Well, not actually the supermarkets exactly. It was really the brokerages, the guys who were the wine buyers who were buying the wines and then selling them onto the supermarkets, decided to send in basically Kiwi and Aussie winemakers because we, obviously, with the hemisphere difference, we're out of work when we're not busy when the Northern Hemisphere is happening. So so all the Kiwis and Aussies were getting packed off to Romania, to Bulgaria, south of Russia, south of France,
mm-hmm.
Spain, Italy,
sure.
even Portugal, all of those kind of areas. And basically you'd rock in the day that harvest started. No idea of the language. It was sort of pointing at things and gesticulating madly, and just it was essentially improving the wines by cleaning equipment properly because they had no idea about hygiene generally,
mm-hmm.
and temperature control of the fermentations. That was basically what you're doing, and picking the grapes at the right time. So it was really rudimentary winemaking, but
right.
just doing those basic things made a huge difference to the wines.
Okay.
And it brought about a consistency, and from there on, flying winemaking evolved to where the contracts would be, instead of 6 weeks, that'd be 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be there 3 or 4 weeks before harvest, buying the fruit.
So it's still in practice quite
it's still
frequently.
It's still in practice, yeah. Still going strong.
So back to where you are now, Viamanette is the name of the family vineyard that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been there for now how many years?
7 years.
7 years. You tell us, I know for my own, that it's a beautiful, beautiful place, very special part of the world. 3 hours or so outside of Santiago in the Colchagua Valley. And the history of this particular family is what exactly?
Well, the Viamanette family, it's a name that always confuses people because it doesn't sound particularly Spanish. That's because it's not. It's Catalan.
Mm-hmm.
The Viamanettes emigrated to Chile shortly before the Civil War in Spain in the 1920s. And basically they'd had nothing to do with wine in Spain, but got to Chile and saw this huge opportunity to start working with wine.
Hmm.
The founder of the winery, Miguel View, he was actually a chef. So he was obviously a guy who had worked a lot with wine and loved wine and had grown up with it. He got to Chile and just saw the potential, much as I did, I think, and that the land, the climate, everything else, and the possibility to make great wine. So him, together with his wife, Dolores Manent, they founded the winery. It started off as a negociant. So they essentially first off bought a factory, if you like, or a bodega in mm-hmm. Santiago. And they would buy finished wines from other companies and make their own blends, blending to their own style that was bottled under the label Vinos View. And it was sold throughout Santiago. They grew over the next 2 or 3 decades to the point where they had a chain of of wine stores or wine cellars around around the country, mm-hmm. primarily in Santiago and Viña del Mar and Valparaíso. In fact, there's a great photo from the 1950s of the famous Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. It's a really famous photo of him, a profile shot, black and white, in the port where he lived, Valparaíso. Mm-hmm. And right behind his head is a big billboard that says, Salud con Vinos View.
Oh, yeah.
So that sort of shows the origins of the company. Then the son of Miguel took over, also called Miguel, took over in the 1960s. That was when he had a different vision for the company. He wanted to move towards being a grower-producer. So that was when View Manent acquired its first vineyards. They bought the property in Cunaco, San Carlos Estate, which was a really old winery and vineyard, which had already been producing wine for around 50 years at that point. And that's when they started growing their own grapes, making their own wine. The company's now in the third generation. It's run by a guy called Jose Miguel View, who you know well.
Yep.
And he's the boss. And we've grown to the point where we have three different vineyards, all in the Colchagua Valley. So mm-hmm. we're very much a Colchagua Valley-focused winery. We currently produce 80% of our own grapes. The 20% which we buy in from growers comes from cooler regions, mainly Casablanca and the Leda Valley, which are regions more focused on
the white wine.
The whites, the Chardonnay, the Sauvignon Blanc, and the Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everything else comes from our own vineyards within Colchagua. And as a winery, we're really well known in Chile as the Malbec producers. We're the Malbec pioneers. We're the first winery to come out with a Malbec back in 1994.
Well, I can't wait to hear about that, as I'm sure our listeners would like to hear more about the Malbec. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back. This is Death Cab for Cutie with Soul Meets Body. Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick at The Root of It. We're out here in Roberta's in Bushwick on the first sunny day in about 6 days. So I'm glad, Grant, you are having this opportunity to see some sun in New York City, because it's been a little dreary, a little dreary.
Well, if you think it's been dreary, you should have seen Santiago yesterday. It was pouring with rain.
Really? Yeah, it's winter now there.
It's winter. It's cold.
It's cold.
I could cut glass with my nipples.
For our listeners who are just joining us, this is Grant Phelps. He's a chief winemaker at Viña Manent in the Colchagua Valley in Chile. And he was just telling us a little bit about his position at Viña Manent, a little bit about the history of the family. And I think it's interesting, given the notes that you just made about your inspiration for going to Chile, as well as the Villa family's inspiration to going and seeing the potential that Chile has for winemaking. And can we talk a little bit about those geographical climate figures that really make it so stand out amongst other wine producing regions?
Okay. I mean, I think Chile is, for me, it's probably been said a lot of times before about a lot of places, but Chile for me is a winemaker's paradise. I've made wine in 7 countries, and it was only when I arrived in Chile that I thought, this is the place I want to stay and make wine. I mean, I'm from New Zealand. New Zealand's a place famous for its wine. We make a lot of great wine. But in New Zealand, it rains. It's kind of shitty climate, you know? Mm-hmm. Kind of like New York, maybe, with less humidity.
We're going to will that away, actually.
Yeah. I mean, New Zealand, it rains a lot during harvest. I mean, Chile is a country which is truly blessed climatically. It doesn't rain from basically September all the way through to May. So we have eight months of the year, essentially, with no rain. That's perfect because that covers, obviously, remembering that we're in the other hemisphere, so it's around the other way compared with where you guys are here. But it's from bud break through until harvest, no rain whatsoever. It's great because it means we can pick the grapes when we want to pick the grapes as a winemaker. We don't have to pick them because they're going moldy, because rot's setting in, because things are turning ugly. In New Zealand, a lot of the time, the winemaking's a sort of a happy kind of balance between, or an unhappy balance sometimes between, it's not quite right, but it's going to go rotten, I better pick it. In Chile, it's really about picking it when you feel as a winemaker that the flavors are just right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the Goldilocks situation, if you like. Also in Chile, there's no phylloxera, which I don't know if your listeners are familiar with phylloxera in general, but phylloxera is a root louse, which is your gift to the rest of the world, basically. It's from North America. The grapevine...
Our gift.
This was sort of... this is where terrorism... Maybe this is the first recorded incident of international terrorism, was when the Americans decided to export Native American vines to Europe, and unwittingly, I'm sure... they exported a bug with them because they had no idea of quarantine at the time. We're talking about the mid-1800s.
Right.
Phylloxera, it was a stowaway on the roots of the vines, and it got into Europe and went, hey, fiesta. Within about 30 years, it killed all of the vines within all of Europe. I mean, we're talking Portugal down to Italy, all the way up over to, I don't know, Romania. So everyone had to replant their vineyards. It's spread everywhere else. We've got it in New Zealand and Australia and South Africa. Argentina's even got it. But for some reason, no one can quite explain why it's never arrived in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of result of phylloxera is it means that if you want to grow vines with a phylloxera, you have to grow French or Italian or Spanish vines grafted onto American rootstocks because only the American rootstocks are resistant.
Right.
Chile, that doesn't happen. Chile's the only place in the world where you can reliably find vineyards planted on their own roots. So the Cabernet Sauvignon is on Cabernet Sauvignon roots. Mm-hmm. The Syrah is on Syrah roots, and so forth.
Yeah, it's very unique. Yeah.
It's very unique, and the big advantage means that we've got a lot of old vineyards in Chile because when you plant on grafted vines or vines grafted onto rootstocks, they have a much lower life expectancy. It's kind of like if you get run over by a bus, now they can stitch your leg back on.
Mm-hmm. But that leg's not going to ever function as well as it did before.
You're going to walk funny, Aaron. That's what's going to happen. You'll walk, but you'll walk funny. If an own-rooted vine has a life expectancy of 60 or 70 years on average, much like a human being, a grafted vine is more like 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that in the rest of the world, when the vineyard gets to 25, 30 years old, you've already lost 20 or 30% of your vines due to natural attrition. The economically viable thing to do is bulldoze the entire thing, rip everything out, and replant from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in Chile is because the vines are on their roots, because there's no phylloxera, when vines start to die off after 50 or 60 years, you grow a root, on the neighbor of the dead vine, you grow a shoot long at pruning time, you don't prune it all, you let it grow long, you plant that shoot into the ground the next winter, you push it into the ground, and then out comes a new vine, and that vine's connected to the mother plant, and you leave it connected to the mother plant for 3 years while it develops a deep root system, and then mm-hmm. you cut it off. And that means that just with normal watering practices, that vine survives and flourishes. Normally, if you plant a new vine in a grafted vineyard, it won't have any root systems, so it'll die unless you're willing to completely overwater the rest of the block.
Right.
And that's why everywhere else in the world you have to bulldoze and start again. In Chile, we've got a lot of 50, 60, 70, even 100-year-old vineyards.
Yeah.
And that's the only place in the world where I've really seen that consistently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, average vines, a lot of your vineyards are 70 to 80 years.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, as a winemaker, that's a beautiful thing because as a winemaker...
Not to say that your job's made too much easier. We know you work very hard, but...
we still work hard, but I mean, as a winemaker, it's like being a chef. It's all about the raw material. As a chef, you can...
Product, yeah.
As a bad chef, you can start with great raw material and cook average food. winemaking's the same. You can be the greatest chef in the world. If you've got bad raw material, the food's not going to be good. The wine's not going to be good either.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's the big advantage of Chile. We've got a lot of great raw material.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Combine that with the climate. Also, there's no downy mildew, which is another one of the major vine pests. And because it doesn't rain, we just don't need to spray. I mean, Chile is a country which potentially could be 100% organic without any major issues. It costs a bit more, and that's the issue at the moment. Chilean wine in the world still has that sort of bad reputation, if you like, as good, cheap, drinkable, quaffing red
mm-hmm,
wine.
Mm-hmm.
And Chile, I think the message I'd like to send out to everyone today is that Chile has incredible potential to make some of the best wines in the world, but people have to be, consumers have to be willing to pay for that. Because to be able to make those wines, you need to invest a lot of money. You need to plant the vineyards on hillsides, which costs about four times as much as on the flat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the the winery, there's just so much more investment. So
so much more investment than where?
Than cheap wines, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I think there's still that sort of misconception out there that Chili's makes great $8 bottles of wine.
Right,
but
right.
When it comes to $20 bottles of wine or $30 bottles of wine, suddenly people are going, oh, I could buy an Italian or a Spanish mm-hmm. or a French wine or a New Zealand or Australian for the same price.
Mm-hmm.
Why buy Chilean? Chile's got a real problem as a wine producing country because it's the image thing. When you're buying an $8 bottle of wine, you don't need to know where it's coming from. You just want a wine that's good for $8.
Sure.
Above $15 to $20, you want to have an idea of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Chile has a huge problem with that. I know for me, I mean, I went there to make wine the first time 9 years ago. I had no idea what Chile looked like before I got there.
Right.
I stepped off the plane and went, so this is what Chile looks like. Chile is a country which is, for me, it's kind of the best kept secret in the world.
Yeah, that's what I felt like. And I feel like most people I've talked to who have been there have been blown away just by its expanse and its the different types of landscape that you get from the north to the south and everything in between is just stunning.
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah. I'm from New Zealand. Everyone goes, you're a Kiwi, a god, New Zealand, you're so beautiful, man. I'd love to go there. Okay, for me, Chile is the only country which beats New Zealand in terms mm-hmm. of raw, natural, unexploited beauty. Chile is the longest, skinniest country in the world. It's 5,000 miles from top to bottom. On average, it's only about 180 miles wide. That just gives you an idea. In the north, yeah. We go from the driest desert in the world, the Atacama Desert. In some parts, it hasn't rained for over 2,000 years, which officially makes it drier than the Sahara. Down to the south, it's Patagonia. I mean, it rains, 345 days of the year. It's windy, it's cold.
Right.
But starkly beautiful. I mean, it's these extremes in Chile are just amazing. On the western border, we've got the Pacific Ocean. On the east, it's the Andes Mountains. We have the highest peak in the world. I drive past it every couple of weeks when I go to Argentina to look at the wine I'm making over there. Aconcagua, Mount Aconcagua, it's the highest peak in the world outside of the Himalayas. You've got so much stuff in such a small space in Chile, and climatically it really is just, it's a remarkable country.
Mm-hmm. That was one of my inspirations for going there as well, I think, was not knowing necessarily what to expect with respect to landscape, but also knowing that the potential for wine there was grand. But not being enough exposed to it here, because I feel like there's a lot of things that are made there that you don't see in a retail capacity here, or even on restaurant wine lists. So going to find out for myself, you know, this best kept secret was my inspiration.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, as a New Zealand winemaker, my experience before was when I traveled internationally to promote our wines, to do winemaker dinners and so forth. This is, you know, we're talking pre-Lord of the Rings here as well. Everyone already knew what New Zealand was. And the same thing happened with Australia. You know, Australia mm-hmm. has been such a boom, an explosion of wine in the US, because you might not have been to Australia, but you've seen Crocodile Dundee. You've
right,
heard the
right.
chuck another prawn on the barbie cobber thing. And, you know, you've got an idea of where the wine's coming from. And that's right. why Australia's just gone off. You know, it's
yeah.
been amazing. Chile's,
no one has that visual for Chile.
Chile has no idea. I mean, Argentina is our competition, if you like,
right.
down there. And Argentina, even though it started to export wine to the US 10 or 15 years after Chile, has a huge image here because everyone's heard of Buenos Aires. Everyone knows about Tango and Gauchos and the meat
yeah.
and the Malbec and everything else. Whereas Chile, people just draw an absolute blank. And it's a huge problem because I think we've got this, so much potential to make
huge
great,
problem, but
great
also
wine.
A huge opportunity.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
If we can get our act together and actually start selling our country. I mean, for me, it's hard as a winemaker because I go abroad, like I am right here in New York, mm-hmm. doing events like tomorrow. Tomorrow, I mean, bearing in mind it's for sommeliers, I'm not going to start off talking about our wines. I'm going to start off of the 2 hours I've got to talk, 20 minutes will be devoted to Chile, what it is and what it looks like, because no one's actually been there.
Right.
And so to taste the wines, you need to have an idea.
Right.
It's so important to taste wines with some kind of context. You know, as you know, it's fine to taste Italian wines in isolation, but when you taste them with the food of the region and mm-hmm. you realize there's so much
all
gastronomic,
comes together.
It all comes together. And the same goes for Chile.
Right. Well, thanks so much for sharing. You have so much to give. So we are doing another segment next week with you still here. And just want to thank you again. And we will close today's segment with the song by The Sounds. Thanks again to our sponsor, VS Imports in New York. See you next week.